for this analysis. So in this slide, what I want to show you is for each of those genes, what you see in yellow, is the total length of the alignment. In red is the length of the alignment after taking out the ambiguous regions, and in blue, the informative, the phylogenetic informative characters. What is interesting here is that you can see that, for example, 20AS, the number of phylogenetic informative characters is really small. So most people usually believe that if you're dealing with molecular data, you have a huge amount of data, but actually you do have much more usually than morphology, but the informative characters might be a tiny fraction of the whole data you have in hand. Okay, so this is a tree, and I hope you don't mind, but you're not going to be able to see the terminals, but that's a little bit irrelevant for this talk. So again, coccinality was recovered as a monophyletic group, no surprise. This is the consensus tree of the three most parsimonious trees recovered in this analysis. So, according to this hypothesis, sticholotidine is not monophyletic, calochorine is not monophyletic, coccinelline is monophyletic, apilaconine monophyletic, scimenine not monophyletic, coccidioline not monophyletic, the subfamiliar status of exoplectrine or taliine and asiine not supported, but it does support the subfamiliar status for microasiine. So in summary, four out of the six traditional recognized subfamilies were not recovered as monophyletic, and for the four other subfamilies proposed, only one, according to this hypothesis, is supported at the subfamilial level. Now, this is a simplified cladogram from the one I just showed you to show the relationship between the subfamilies. So this hypothesis supported microasiine at the most basal group in the family, followed by apilaconine, and then you have a dichotomy in one clade, all the tribes of coccidioline, scimenine, and calochorine, but you're seeing them here as a subfamily, but all those lines you see is to say that they're not none of them are actually monophyletic. And then you have another clade with sticholotidine, in this analysis represented by sticholotis, and calochorine and coccinoline. The calochorine you see here are members of the tribe Calochorini. So this hypothesis is quite different from Sasaji and Kobayashi, and especially regarding the position of apilaconine, which now it's not recovered as sister group of coccinoline, and it is in a much more basal position. But it's quite similar to what you recover in his analysis. As you can see, he always got apilaconine, the same position as this hypothesis recovered. Probably for those that are interested in coccinellate phylogeny, the most new and somehow disturbing result here is recovering calochorine as sister group of coccinoline, which have never been recovered before. So other than the molecules, there isn't many morphological characters to support this group. And with that being said, I would like to stress out that this is still an ongoing project. So we still have a long way to go until we have the final results on a final tree, but it has a pretty good support, at least to say that those subfamilies are not monophyletic. So the take-home message here is that Coxnelly classification is in desperate need of revision. It just doesn't reflects what we believe the evolution of the group is. We are actually in the process of sequencing more taxa, both to the out-group and in-group. We have sequenced 10 additional tribes already. Unfortunately, I couldn't have those in this analysis, but we are working on the taxa sampling heavily. We have several other new additional tribes in alcohol waiting to be sequenced. Nuclear protein genes had proved to be pretty informative at different levels of phylogeny. So we are going to include at least EF1 alpha and wingless. We have data for half the taxa at this point, but had some problems simplifying those genes. I'm going to be focused on that during next spring. So finally, we really want to combine this molecular data with morphological data, and any attempt to propose a new and update system of classification wouldn't come before including morphological data in the analysis. So I'd like to, just to remind you that is a collaborative project. So we have Adam Zapinski, Laurie Shapiro, Kelly Miller, Joe McHugh, and Mike Whiting are collaborating in this project. And I'd like to thank a couple of other people that help. Those beautiful lady beetle illustrations you saw came from Guillermo Gonzalez web page. You should check it because it's a pretty neat work. And I'll take questions.
We have about a minute and a half for questions, if anybody has any.
This is probably dumb enough to ask in closing the questions, but
why not? No, actually not. If you see the Stachylotidae are predators, so there was a shift, but the shift to phytophagy might have been much earlier than we think it is, but the ancestor of Coccinellid was a predator because Epilacinina is not the sister group of all the other Coccinellids.
Good morning. I just want to provide us a brief overview of some of the coccinellids that have been major players in biological control of homopterans. Spend a little time talking about just a quick overview of some of the evaluation techniques, and then use a couple of examples from my co-authors who have worked with the cotton aphid and soybean aphid to demonstrate some of the ways in which the role of lady beetles in biological control of homopteran has been demonstrated. Certainly we just had two talks about phylogeny and relationships of the lady beetles. Obviously when you start looking at lady beetles and looking at homopterans, it's really important to understand the relationships between the beetles, the predator-prey relationships, and how those phylogenies interact. So it's critical for this type of work that we just heard about to continue so we have a better understanding of what we're doing with these beetles for biological control. All of you can think of different examples, both historical examples as well as fairly recent examples of lady beetles that have been used for biological control or suppression of some of the major groups of homopteran pests. Starting with the Vidalia beetle, going up through hemlock woolly adelgid, current projects, the soybean aphid, which we'll talk more about. So it's not just historical, it's not just the lady beetle fantasy that happened in the late 1800s and early 1900s, they continue to be major important predators in biological control of Haemopterans. Certainly if you start looking at the literature and just doing some quick little bit of survey with keywords in some of our abstracts, you can see that this is and continues to be a very active group, a very active area of research. If you just do some keyword searching in a couple of the major abstracts, you'll find lots and lots of papers. Obviously, you'd have to go in and look at these relative to what the specifics are, but in terms of an active field relative to biological control, the lady beetles continue to be one of the major predatory groups involved in suppressing some of these key pests. Just a quick examples of some of the ways in which we try to determine the role of biological control of lady beetles in biological control. These sort of categories are taken from the review article by Bob Luck. If you look at that review article from 1988, there's about 11 examples of lady beetles that are being evaluated for biological control through a variety of means. Certainly from the perspective of classical biological control, introducing a predatory insect, following it over time, the Vidalia beetle, cottony cushion scale, an excellent example of how that was followed over time, even though the actual mechanisms of what was going on with that interaction weren't really studied till much later in the 60s and 70s by Paul DeBock and his students. But long-term suppression brought about through introductions, certainly a very strong methodology for use to evaluate the impact of lady beetles. A variety of exclusion, inclusion, cage types of studies, use of chemical exclusion, anything you can think of that continues historically, that's been widely used, it continues to be used, it continues to provide a number of important insights into their impact. Gut content analysis methods, a range of things. We're going to hear more about molecular techniques later on. I'll just use a couple of examples from the work that James Harwood has been doing with a soybean aphid. But lady beetles are large enough. There are studies in terms of gut dissections that started in the 1880s with Stephen Forbes doing dissections of carabids and lady beetles to determine what they fed upon. And they continue up to the present, where studies in Germany in the 1999 by Tillisch did a very elegant study of what lady beetles had fed upon based on what they could determine from aphid parts or thrip parts in their guts. I know one of Ted Evans' students is continuing to work on gut analysis or fecal analysis of what these insect, what these predators have preyed upon. And certainly because of their larger size, many individuals are able to do visual observations of what insects have been preyed upon. Alejandro Costamanga has done a very nice study with soybean aphids looking at some of the lady beetle predators on levels of predation because of the size, and you can make observations of those insects. Just to give you a little idea of what the sort of the value of doing some gut content analysis, either with immunological or molecular techniques, these to me would be combined with other sorts of either field cage studies or field observations, visual methodology. It does allow you to take samples from the field, so you have field populations. You're not trying to manipulate those populations in cages or do other things that that introduce some level of artificial means of human manipulation. And they certainly provide you with additional ecological insights relative to the role of alternate prey, biodiversity, that you can't get probably any other way. So I think it's a really a good additional tool to add to what we're able to understand the interactions of lady beetles. James Harwood put together a paper in 2005 looking at studies that have used gut content analysis for aphid predators. You can see where the arrow is. There's been about 20 studies up till 2005. There's been a couple additional studies. The majority of those studies with lady beetles have involved gut dissections, two or three immunological studies, and only a couple of studies that use DNA fragments to determine predation. If you look across the taxa there, is it the reason that these gut analysis are not more widely used due to the biology of the taxa or due to the emphasis and the focus of the groups who are looking at these taxa. It might be a combination of both based on their predatory behaviors. The couple case studies that I want to just mention, these are based on the work that my co-authors have done. One involves the cotton aphid, and that's Tim Kring and his workers in Arkansas, and the other is a soybean aphid, which would be James Harwood and Bob O'Neill from Kentucky and Indiana. First, the cotton aphid. Depending on where you are in the country, the cotton aphid can be considered an occasional pest. Every so often, different locations, it does pop up as a problem. In other locations in Arkansas, it may not be a problem from year to year. Other locations of the country, this may be occurring in cotton, have non-pest status, and in fact, some people have looked at it as a potentially as a beneficial insect because it allows the buildup of predators in that particular system. So cotton aphid, the importance of the cotton aphid varies geographically. What Tim did in terms of a combined research extension group at the University of Arkansas looked at how they could incorporate biotic mortality brought about by lady beetles into existing thresholds for the cotton aphid in Arkansas. This just gives you an example, pictorial example of some of the predators that are using cotton aphids in Arkansas to build up their populations. You look at the little the diagram, you see about 3/4 of all the predators found in cotton, feeding on cotton aphids, are lady beetles, a combination of different species, adults and larvae. And this data set was based on a 3-year field study where they're out doing weekly samplings of both of aphids and the various predators feeding on those aphids. The existing threshold in Arkansas was related to the number of plants that were infested and whether or not the aphid population was increasing. What Tim Kring and his colleagues did was use that existing threshold and just build on it by adding in, you know, not only are there plants infested and are the aphid populations building, but are there a number of lady beetle larvae and adults per row foot? And if there's not the lady beetles present, then you can treat. If there are, you wait 7 days and sample again. So this allows that biotic mortality to be incorporated into the threshold, takes an existing threshold, just adds the presence of these relatively large insects that are easy to see. Obviously, you don't have scouts looking for skimness in the field. They wouldn't see them, but they will see Hippodamia convergens and the seven-spotted lady beetle. So this particular example shows that you can use an existing threshold, incorporate biotic mortality due to the predators, eliminating some insecticide sprays depending on the year and the conditions, delays that first treatment. This particular threshold, which incorporates these predators, has been adopted by about 70% of the growers in Arkansas. So evaluated the mortality, incorporated the mortality, and now it's being used. Let's move on to the soybean aphid. Certainly, most people realize what an impact the soybean aphid has had in Midwest soybean production. And it involves currently now, there's a number of different projects ongoing involving importation of parasitoids, looking at what the existing predators are doing, plant resistance, pathogens, a whole range of different approaches are being used for the soybean aphid. I'm just going to focus on some of the lady beetle work. There's been numerous studies. You look at the literature, very recent studies from a number of labs throughout the Midwest looking at the roles of the aphid predators that are in the field, including the work from Michigan, Wisconsin, Indiana. I just put up a couple of examples of the types of studies that have been done both in the field, field cages, and lab studies. And Alejandro Castamano has done some field observations where they're not caged, the beetles and the aphids aren't caged in anything. There is variation in the complex that's supposed to be when on my computer. When you go for a picture of Aureus, Bob O'Neill shows up. So I don't know why he doesn't. I don't know if he looks like Aureus or there's a giant sucking sound, but you know, there is variation in the complex depending on what state, what area you're in, what you're looking at. Wisconsin, they found quite a number of predatory dipteran larvae having an important role in reducing aphid populations. Certainly in Indiana, Bob has focused a lot on the early season predation by Aureus and how important that is for suppressing building populations of the soybean aphid. But in all these situations, in all locations, the lady beetle larvae and adults are playing a role, and in many cases a major role, in suppressing the soybean aphid. In Michigan, for example, recent work has looked at these four species as being the major predators found in the soybean aphid system. And you look at the Harmonia, Hippodamia, and Coccinella species, those are all introduced species, and there's only one native species that's showing up in this sort of predatory complex. This group represents almost 60% of all the predators in a study done in Michigan. And you can see Harmonia axeritus, which has some evolutionary history with the soybean aphid in Asia, is showing up both as the most common adult as well as a very significant proportion of the immature stages. So where are our Nearctic species? Historically, if you look at examples of aphid pests that have been introduced into North America, what typically happens is our native species colonizes those agricultural crops, be it the pea aphid, be it the spotted alfalfa aphid. They move in and bring about some level of aphid suppression that's usually then looked at in terms of what could be added to it. But where are our Nearctic species? Why are we not seeing several species of Coccinella that are the Nearctic species, Hippodamia species? And you know, when I was doing work in New York in the mid-80s, I would have a complex of four or five different species of Coccinella and Hippodamia, and I would also would have expected to see a much higher level of Coleomagilla. At least in the studies in Michigan, it's there, but it's in relatively low levels. So when we look at what the existing biological control of the soybean aphid is, we have both a mixture of native and introduced predators, not only the lady beetles, but if you look at the lady beetles, in most cases, the most abundant or what's been measured as the most significant predators are introduced species. Obviously, okay, you start looking at soybeans. Soybeans are introduced. Soybean aphids introduced. Soybean overwintering hosts are introduced. So what kind of, when you start looking at the literature and looking at these papers, yes, we're documenting what is naturally occurring predation in these soybean fields, but is that, you know, what sort of a system do we have there? I mean, we've got a system where, is this fortuitous biological control, where classical biological control has been done in reverse, and now we've got the pest there? So it does make you think about what sorts of responses you'll get from these predators relative to what evolutionary history they've had with the pest and with the crop. So it is a very interesting system, and obviously now the focus is on introducing some aphid parasites from Asia, and that's looked at sort of as the classical biological control component. People are looking at fungi and other things. But in terms of the predators that are out there, it's already sort of a very mixed bag of a system. Just another question, there's a fourth species of introduced lady beetle that's sort of in New York, and I know moving across Ohio, and is this going to become even another addition to this complex, which may, you know, again, just emphasize that we've got sort of an introduced system growing in the Midwest, and a number of these sort of, number of these introduced lady beetles are now playing major roles in that. When you have this sort of multiple predatory system, you have a number of interactions going on, and just want to use one I just want to use one example from work that James Harwood and Bob O'Neill did that tried to pull apart some of the interactions between some of the predators. And this particular study, it was based in Indiana. Aureus is a major predator early season in Indiana soybean fields, and then Harmonia would move in later on. Bob and his students and postdocs made some observations where they hypothesized that Aureus was in the field early feeding on soybean aphids, but when Harmonia moved into the field, laid some eggs, they were hypothesizing that Aureus may start feeding on the Harmonia eggs and may actually delay the buildup of Harmonia larvae later in the field. So the question, sort of based on this sort of seasonal pattern, was a good question to use molecular gut analysis. And this particular series of techniques were taking some DNA segments from the soybean aphid and looking at the predation rates of Aureus. So there was documented evidence there about the importance of Aureus. In addition, taking some DNA fragments from Harmonia and looking to see whether or not Aureus from the field was actually feeding on Harmonia. This would be the type of pattern you would see for Harmonia eggs, at least in Indiana in 2005, where you'd get eggs later in the season, then you get a buildup of eggs and larvae. So the question is, do Aureus feed on these eggs? The answer, based on using molecular techniques, was no. All the Aureus that were collected were tested against Harmonia, and they were not found to be feeding on Harmonia eggs. So I know we'll hear more about this later on, but this is a new technique. It certainly can provide new insights, and it can answer and address questions that we haven't been able to address before, and it certainly complements everything we've been trying to do with field and cage and laboratory studies. And there are certain advantages, and obviously there's certain costs involved in this, but it is a very, I think, powerful tool that we should be looking at maybe a little more closely. Thank you.
I want to kind of introduce you a little bit to, my job's a little simpler because there's not that many coccinellas that really feed on mites, but I also want to talk a little bit about the history of probably one of the most successful biological control programs of mites that includes a coccinella, and it's probably one that's lasted the longest. So we have actually a couple generations of workers that are working in here between Larry and myself. I actually worked on that when I was a student with Larry. When you're looking at coccinella predators of mites, really you're really only talking about the genus Stethrus, but there are a number of other species that are known to kind of graze on mostly the spider mites, sometimes rust mites. Epidamia convergens, Ola abdominalis, and some of these other Scimnus species and other things, but they generally don't reproduce on it. It's just generally something that they'll use for an extra supplement to their diet, and they generally don't reproduce on it. When we're looking at coccinella specialists on mites, we're really talking about Stethrus, which is a fairly primitive group. These are obligate specialists, mostly just on spider mites, tetranychids. And they will attack other mites when they're starving, like phytoceid predators. They'll also feed on some rust mites, but they don't do very well on them. They're very geared toward tetranychid mites, and sometimes they don't even do very well.
Okay, so you want to teach. And I look out there and I see a lot of master teachers. Okay, let me go on with this just a bit here. Okay, first of all, Martha asked me if I would do a talk for beginning teachers. And again, I see some people, I feel like I'm preaching to the choir here with Ken Juergen and Triple Horn, and I see several people. Anyway, how many have taught for more than 5 years? Okay, well, you guys can leave. All right. How many have taught for less than 5 years? How many have never taught at all? Oh, there's a couple of you I can talk to. Okay. Well, I teach at a community college, and so I'm going to kind of gear this at a very, very beginning level. The last four people we've hired at the community college have all had PhDs in various fields, and they end up teaching general biology 101. All right? And so this is kind of, whether you're a beginning instructor, whether you're an assistant professor, whatever your title is, you're starting out, okay? You're just beginning. All right. And the theme for this year's ESA conference is is beautiful for teaching, right? Innovation, initiative, and an influence. These are three primary things you're going to be doing as a teacher. I'm not going to take them necessarily in this order. To me, we do the initiative first, and then we do the innovation, and then finally we do the influence. And so I'll kind of go along in that theme. And following up on what Ken started with earlier here, role models. You are graduate students, or you've been through graduate school, and you've got all those wonderful teachers that you've had for mentors, you know, maybe it's high school or college, but you've got all those wonderful teachers you've had. And make a list of the things you like best about those teachers. And that is, I think, primary, as Ken mentioned earlier. List those positive qualities, the things you want to be able to do as you continue your educational endeavors. And while you're at it, you might make a list of some of the negative qualities as well. Don't do these again, right? Teaching is an art, as Martha's pointed out, perhaps. There is the educational theory behind it, and she's given you a wonderful background there. But we also have, it may be some art as well. Attitude. Enthusiasm, passion. This is what teaching is about. And if you have that passion for teaching, it's going to come across as you enter into this role as a teacher. Job or profession, what is it? If you're looking for a 9-to-5 paid job, I'm not sure you want to go into education, because it ends up not being quite 9-to-5. You need to make that commitment to students. And a lot of you also have a discipline, and you have your commitment to a discipline. And sometimes you can weave the two together. But as you're teaching, you need to make sure you have that commitment to your students. Make sure you're zeroing in on them first, all right? And they pick this up very, very well. But most of us do try to blend the two together, and we work on our discipline or our research, and we also have our teaching. But teaching is primary. If we look at my head title here, Enjoy Students. If you enjoy students and you respect the process of learning, all right, you will become a good teacher. We all know that teaching is contagious, or education is contagious, and we've been in group learning situations where if you can turn some students on, it'll inspire other students, and it becomes a contagious attitude. I mean, we find this in graduate school, the competition, if nothing else. Maintain a sense of humor, all right? You have to. I can melt some students by just smiling, and I walk down the hall, and they'll say later, "You're always smiling. Why are you always smiling?" I said, "Because I'm happy," and you can just melt students in that way. You're going around glum all the time. You don't belong in this area. You have to enjoy what you're doing. Okay, enjoy it. Respectful. Respect the students. Okay, if you respect them, they'll respect you. It becomes a mutual thing. I'll hit this again a little bit later. But respect is, I think, why you have those mentors up there, and why you learn to respect those, and why you pick those good qualities from those teachers. This was in Time Magazine about 2 weeks ago. Did you see this? I had my talk already, but I had to go back and add this in. And what this was, if I can use the pointer here, and there it is. That's a happy face and a sad face. This was in the middle of the Time Magazine, and they rated people here from the happiest people over in this area, and then they ranked them all the way down here, all the way around, to the people who were least happy. And this was not based on what their money they made. It's not money, okay? It's how happy they were in the profession they had, all right? And I'll jump forward here just a minute. Clergy ranked at 67.2. Post-secondary teachers, all the college-level teachers, ranked at 38.9. That's how happy. How many of them were happy? Gas station attendants were down at 13.2. Now you go back on this one. Okay, so here's the clergy way up here in the top. They were the happiest people they found in this survey. All right? Secondary school teachers, college ages, were right down about here. Okay? And, of course, the gas station attendants were up here. Now, this bothered me. This really bothered me. Because when you look at the clergy, 2/3 of them were happy, or said they were happy at what they were doing. Only 2/3? But then it was worse when you got to the college teachers. Only 4 out of 10 said they were happy at what they were doing. That's contagious, okay? And those people need to move on and find something else to do. I mean, you need to be happy at what you're doing. I mean, I've been at this business for 45 years plus, and I love it. I still, people ask me, when are you going to retire? I'm retirement age. When are you going to retire? I don't know. I'm still happy at what I'm doing. And if you're happy at what you're doing, you do it well. And the students sense this. And you can, it's so much easier to teach if you enjoy what you're doing, right? I see Dr. Triplehorn sitting here smiling, right? Okay. Anyway, if you looked at that rank that I had, that the time thing had there, secondary school teachers rank right between dispatchers and secretaries in happiness. To me, that was really scary. Okay. Gas station attendants, 13%. I was surprised. 13% of them are happy what they're doing. Okay. Well, anyway, that was just kind of a thing about attitude and your enthusiasm and passion for teaching. Okay, so getting on to the meat of the topic, initiative, innovation, and influence. I'm going to do the initiative part first. All right? Before, you know, you may have a graduate degree and be the best ecologist in the world, and you know so much more than the freshman students coming in. You can't walk in the classroom the first day and think, okay, I know more than they do, so I can teach. No, you have to do some planning ahead of time. Okay, do some planning ahead of time. And I heard Dr. Juergen talk about the planning ahead of time. It may not look like their plan. I mean, sometimes you can have students help you with the planning. At least they think they're helping you. But you have that plan already in mind. You are organized. You have some organizational skills. So you've organized your class. You've organized your labs. You know what's going on. You know what you want the students to get out of the class. You've got some objectives that are in mind, okay? So you know what you want them to walk out of this classroom at the end. And whether this is a freshman biology class or if it's a graduate level, IPM class, you have those objectives, and you have to have the organization and the planning to go with it. So when we talk about the initiative, the very, very beginning documents, we come up with course policies for the course. And I'll go over these here in a minute. When you need to have a course syllabus, this is all that initiative planning before you ever start. And you should have some outcomes, some objectives, what you want the students to get out of this. It may be in rubrics, and I don't know if Martha's going to get into this later or not, but it's a way to measure the objectives that you have established. So, policies. Let's go with nuts and bolts 101. All right, this is what you need to do first in that planning stages. Vital information for the class. This sounds so elementary. But I've actually seen some beginning teachers walk in. Okay, what text are we going to use? Well, it's over in the bookstore. It's listed over there. If maybe you don't have a text, in writing. Put this policies in writing so you can hand it to the students and they've got it. It's like a contract then, right? And so they know exactly, okay, this is the text I'm going to use for the class. I need the 9th edition, not the 8th edition or the 7th edition. Or do you have handouts? Maybe you don't have a text, but you have that in your policy, so they know what it is. You have your office hours in there. That sounds very elementary. Halfway through a quarter, I'll have a student come up and say, do you have office hours? By the way, where is your office? Okay, look at the syllabus, all right? I even go over the policies with my freshman biology students. I go over the policies with them the first day, so make sure they have actually read this. Attendance, do you have an attendance policy? If you do, it should be written in your policy statement. How are you going to handle makeups? Students are going to have absences, illness, snow, not part of the country, we have snow breaks, okay? Or funerals, or illness, or whatever. What is your policy on makeups? Have it written out so they know exactly what they have to do. They also really want to know your grading policy. Okay, are you going to curve this class? I always hit that. Are you going to curve the class? What is going to be an A? Well, how do I get a 4.0? Have something written out there so they know what percentages are converted to decimals or grades or whatever. And have your instructor contact information there. The phone number, your emails or whatever. Some people don't like to give out phone numbers. Students find phone numbers. They really want to find you. Sometimes it's really nice to have it. I have that on all my handouts I give at the beginning of the quarter. So make it easy for students so they know what they want. Now I know this is way beyond, the preliminary information Dr. Juergen talked about that you hand out the first day. But this is, and again, I'm aiming at these beginning students beginning teachers, okay, who are starting this. More stuff on that syllabus, the very beginning. A list of topics. Students like to know what we're going to cover for the quarter. All right, I've had students drop out the first day after they look at the syllabus. Okay, oh, this isn't the class I thought it was. All right, and possibly even tentative dates. On top of my schedule, I always write tentative because I can't always, you know, be 3 weeks from now on the chapter I say I'm going to be on. So I say tentative schedule. I'll go as fast through these topics as you allow me. All right, or if you need to have more time, we'll go down. So tentative, but a list of topics is helpful. Include roughly exam and quiz schedules. They're unannounced quizzes, tell them you've got unannounced quizzes. Exam schedules, I'll say, okay, after the first three chapters, we're going to have a test. And so you have a rough, they know about what to plan for. Objectives, again, what you want the students to know. Tell them what you want them to know, all right? Don't assume that they're going to know this automatically. Due dates for papers, projects. These are always, it sounds so fundamental for those of us that have been teaching year after year, but it is important for beginning students to know this and to understand the objectives again for the course. So, nuts and bolts 101. Now, innovation. Going into the classroom, and some of the things that I have found that are important in beginning students, or for beginning teachers, and for those freshman students coming in, I've had students actually shake when they take like a lab science class. They're coming in like this, and they can't focus on the microscope. And you need to put those students at ease. One way I find that I put them at ease is to know their names. I teach in a quarter system, so I have 11 weeks with each of my classes. I have 75 students a quarter at a community college level, and I know the names of every student by the fourth day, the end of the first week. Not last names, but first names. And you call them by name, and it terrifies them. Oh my gosh, she knows who I am. And you'll hear them look at each other, she knows me. You know, and that's good. You're establishing a rapport, you're establishing some respect. I also try to know something about each student. And it's wonderful, I mean, all my classes are lab classes, and so we have that you know, walk around and visit with the students, and you find out if you've got a pre-med major, or if you've got an entomology student, or if you have an elementary school teacher, but you learn what their interests are. I've got five kids at home, or, you know, I'm coming back to school after 35 years. We have this wonderful blend of people in the community college system, and you get to know who they are. And then you also need to tell them about you. All right. I mean, you don't have to get personal with them, but you tell them, okay, yeah, I'm a mother. I've got two kids. I've got two grandkids. All right, and I drive 30 miles to work, 35 miles to work through the 4 feet of snow. No, I do commute 36 miles each way, and it's on slippery roads, and so I do expect you to be here. And if not, then I expect you to call me and tell me where you're at. But it's a way to establish this rapport or this respect with students. And I think this innovation thing in the first week is really, really important. It's all about establishing a mutual respect with your student. Okay? And they're antsy. I mean, they're coming in freshman. I know some of you are teaching only graduate level classes. That's altogether different because they're not quite so antsy. Oh, well, some of them are antsy too. But freshman biology students really need to be led by the hand in some cases and be put at ease. All right. Review policies, review schedules. Again, butterflies in the stomach, whatever, they need to know these things. And at the very end of the talk, I have a list of things that I queried my freshman students this quarter. When I knew I was going to give this talk, I said, what would you like to see in an ideal teacher? And I'll share that with you at the very, 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 very end. It's actually what I based the talk on. Okay. So, organization. We've already talked about the syllabus. Remember the organization. I keep hitting this word organization. Organization is crucial here. You've had that syllabus. You've got the policy statement. And you've done that ahead of time. Classroom activities. Lecture, lab, field, you are organized, okay? You know what you're going into for the day. The class can be rather loose or it appears unstructured. You may want it to appear unstructured, but you know what you're trying to accomplish for that day. Organization on field trips. I take a four-day field trip. I take 50 students to the Olympic Peninsula for 4 days. And it takes some organization to get that kind of thing going. Organizations. I mean, who can be more organized than an entomologist, right? Okay? I mean, science is organized, right? And you need to portray that in your in everything you do in that classroom. Be organized because you want the student to be organized, right? And by your showing organization, it's going to foster that in the students. So, what are you going to teach? Make sure the students have the credentials for the class. All right. I teach a zoology class, and I assume the students have had biology 101. And I don't know how your registration process goes, but our students register for the next quarter halfway through the first quarter. And so sometimes, you know, the students will have registered for my zoology class. Biology is a prerequisite, so when they come into zoology, I expect them to know about the microscope and the cells and all the basic stuff we do in general biology. But they dropped out of biology halfway through the quarter, but they got in on the computer, right? So. I see people shaking their heads, okay? So find out what they know. Find out, you know, if they've transferred in, did they ever have a microscope before? I mean, when I do invertebrate zoology, if they don't know what end of the microscope to look through, it's really difficult. And it's amazing. We have a lot of sciences that don't require a lab anymore in general biology. And so you have to know that your students are prepared for what you're about to teach them. We mentioned objectives earlier. I mean, you have course objectives where you want the where you tell the students what you want them to know when they get out of the course, and that may be the syllabus. But then you may also have chapter objectives, and some of our chapters in general biology at least are written so. Okay, we've got three things in this chapter, or two things, that you want to get out of this chapter. All right, and hit those again. Okay, these are the things that you should know when you get out of this chapter. I will be quizzing you on. There may be laboratory objectives. I have a list of objectives I give out with all my laboratory exercises, and we do roughly 16 labs in a quarter. And so they know exactly what they'll have to do when they for a lab exam, how many cells they have to identify, what kind of measurements they have to do, and so on. And there may be units. So you develop your objectives so they know what they're going to be tested on, right? How are you going to teach? Well, class size makes a big difference here. I have one class this quarter of only 13 students. Oh, I don't teach that the way I teach my class of 50. And you have, you know, you can change your whole attitude. You still have the same objectives in mind, right? But you turn the whole class around and do it all together differently if you only have 13, almost becomes one-on-one class of 50. I don't use the total inquiry approach, but even in class of 50 or 55, which are my lecture classes, you ask questions. You begin to ask questions, and you get this feedback constantly from the students. And this is a class of roughly 50, right? And it's amazing how much eye contact you can see. All of a sudden, you see that guy in the back row, and you're calling him, right? No, you know, I don't quite do that. But you can ask a lot of questions. I always start with some really simple questions that everybody can respond to, like, how many years have you taught, right? Okay? Or you say, well, how many of you have had breakfast this morning? Okay. And in a general biology class, that's great because that leads you right into your lecture on biochemistry, right? And then you can talk about ATP, you know, in a molecule of lipid versus, or of triglyceride versus how many ATPs in a glucose and so on and so forth, or where that ATP is coming from. Constantly reviewing. I'm constantly going back on past chapters and bringing things forward. I can't talk about photosynthesis if they don't know about energy. Can't talk about photosynthesis if they don't know cell parts. And so we're constantly reviewing and going back to those areas, and that is reinforcement. And again, there's that objectives word again. There's that word organization again. All right, this is very critical again for your teaching skills here. Positive, or your influence, the third connection, right, from the ESA theme this year, a positive attitude towards students will lead a lot to how the students will respond to you if you have that very, very positive attitude. Let me put this really simple thing up there about returning papers on time. All right, if you're going to give a collect a paper, you should be able to collect it, correct it, and get it back to them within a day or two. Okay, that may be really strict if you've got a big paper, a class of 60, and you've got, you know, maybe not project papers, but daily, but other papers. I do two labs a week with 75 students, and I grade the lab the same night they do the lab and get it back to them next morning. They know exactly what they did right and wrong. I mean, I had a chemistry class where I got all my labs back the day before the final. That's disastrous. It shows no respect for the student. I'm sorry, I'm a little harsh here, but I'm really critical on getting those papers back to students on time. Influence, okay. Relate as much as you can to their real-world examples. This is what Martha has been stressing all along. And sometimes you have to really pull some ideas in here. This one always turns them on. Freshman biology students, right? They love human reproduction. Even animal reproduction is pretty good, exciting, okay? But you get to flower production and talk about megaspores and microspores, okay? So you talk about, okay, what are you going to give your significant other on her birthday or on Valentine's Day? The sexual organs of another organism, right? They usually think about flowers altogether differently at that point, okay? But it's a lead-in, okay? And it makes them help think about that a little bit. Okay, and of course the biochemistry, I already gave you my example for biochemistry. We talk about triglycerides and proteins and, you know, the phenylalanine little label in the back of your pop can, what does that mean, and so on. So relate as much as you can to your lectures, to something they can, as Martha has pointed out so graphically at the beginning, okay? Relevant activities. We've all had assignments, I think, which you think, well, why did the instructor give me that assignment? That was just to keep me busy. And students are really good these days at picking out busy work. Okay, don't give busy work. If it has a meaning, and again, I get a lot of freshman biology students at a community college level, many times at the community college because they didn't qualify to get into a university. All right, and so I have some students that don't have as many skills as some of your university students might have. And so I develop a lot of study guides, but they are relevant study guides. They are study guides that have direct relationship to the lectures we're giving and so forth. And so make sure that they are relevant. Sometimes I have to explain the relevance to it. Okay, the relevance in this picture. I study ants in my research. Okay, and those are baby ants, by the way. Okay, in case you didn't understand the relevance there. All right. The categorization that Martha had at the end of that she skipped over very quickly, and I'm going to skip over too, but these are the levels of knowledge, okay, that you can have in your coursework or in your evaluation of students. Knowledge, of course, is the primary one. I know the definitions of these words, all right? Then comprehension, application. I do all of these in general biology 101, one quarter, okay? You can easily get up to that point of it. We do a little bit of analysis. And then, of course, we don't do as much synthesis and evaluation of data, but in some of my higher courses where we do have projects, we can do that too. But those are the levels, and that's a one little diagram, the back page of Martha's sheet is all on there, okay? Okay. Evaluation of student learning. They want to know what you're going to test them on. Tell them, all right? Tell them what you're going to test them on. It's not a big secret. Okay, and it shouldn't be a big secret. It's in the syllabus, it's in the objectives, it's in the chapter objectives or laboratory objectives or course objectives. So make sure that your evaluations kind of relate to that. I always tell my students, I'm going to give you some application questions. You may never have heard about this topic before, but if you know this, this, and this, you can apply what you know to this new situation. So it's kind of warn them that ahead of time, and it all works out. Sometimes you're called a nitpicker, you know, but whatever. And then the coin flips over, and the students evaluate you. And we have the community college level, at least we evaluate at least once a year, sometimes twice a year, all right? And for brand new teachers, we evaluate every single quarter with student evaluations.